Tonight, we're discussing the book Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity with its author, Steve Silberman. The definition of autism has been evolving over the past several decades. Previously thought to be rare, with an estimated incidence of 1 in 5,000 children in 1975, the CDC recently reported that as many as 1 in 68 kids are now on the spectrum. This perceived rapid rise in prevalence has caused alarm, including here in the Bay Area, where there are fears of a so-called autism epidemic in Silicon Valley. However, the increase in attention of autism has a silver lining: a new appreciation for our author's concept of neurodiversity. In his book, Neurotribes, Steve Silberman chronicles the history of autism, dispels some of the myths surrounding the diagnosis, and uncovers the origins of today's understanding of autism. So tonight we'll examine multiple historical, political, sociological, and scientific threads that help us to understand and shape our perception of autism. We'll talk about how the Nazi eugenics movement, the evolving diagnostic criteria, and a fraudulent scientific paper about vaccines have all been part of coming to terms with how we understand autism. We'll learn how many individuals who would now be classified as autistic have made significant contributions to society. And finally, we'll hear about the relatively recent development of a community of individuals who are autistic who are embracing their condition. And many of these people are fighting for resources and understanding rather than a cure. So joining me in the studio tonight to discuss this book is Steve Silberman, an award-winning science journalist whose writings have appeared in Wired, The New Yorker, the MIT Technology Review, Nature, and other prestigious publications. Neurotribes, in its year since its publication, has received numerous awards, including the 2015 Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction, a California Book Award, Book of the Year for the Medical Journalists Association, and the list goes on. He's has a very popular TED Talk, and we are happy to have Steve Silberman here on the show as his book is released in paperback this week. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, Joseph. It's great to be here. Thank you.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open those phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Steve Silberman, as we were talking before we went to air here, I was talking to you about sort of what I found very compelling about the way you approach the topic of autism from almost a history of science perspective, right? Of really looking at the individuals, and there are many who you profile in the book, the scientists and others who were instrumental in creating our understanding of autism, and seeing them in their historical, political, social context really helps makes us understand, or allows us to understand, how their theories developed. So with that frame, the two main characters, as it were, are Leo Kanner and Asperger, who we hear about quite a bit. And there's really, these are the two main characters. Tell us a little bit about how you understood them to be operating in their time with the information they had available to them, and how that really has shaped what we now know today, or accept perhaps, and accept maybe a fuzzy term there, right? Because there's still controversy here. Accept about the notion of autism.
Sure. Well, when I started out with the basic assumptions that have been sort of repeated in thousands of textbooks and Wikipedia and FAQs online, which was that autism was a condition that was discovered in 1943 by a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore named Leo Kanner. He believed that autism was very, very rare. He profiled in his 1943 landmark paper 11 children who were quite seriously disabled by their condition. And sort of as a footnote to that landmark discovery, another paper came out by this guy Hans Asperger a year later, which was considered really a, sort of a minor contribution. Asperger only described four children. He seemed to describe children who were much less disabled than Leo Kanner had done. And the two discoveries were considered to be purely coincidental, the fact that they discovered or the fact that they wrote their papers a year apart. Anyway, in the course of my research, which encompassed 5 years, really, of full-time work as well as several years of preparation, I learned that that timeline, which has been assumed to be true for decades, was completely incorrect. And that the actual story is that in the mid-1930s, Hans Asperger and his colleagues, who were working at a clinic in Vienna called the Children's Clinic at the University of Vienna, really discovered what we would now call the autism spectrum. Asperger believed that autism was a lifelong condition. He saw it as having a very wide and sort of colorful range of clinical presentations, ranging from children who were really profoundly disabled and would require support for every day of their lives, to one of his former patients actually became an assistant professor of astronomy by detecting an error in one of Isaac Newton's proofs in his freshman year at university. So Asperger and his colleagues had this very broad idea of autism, and what I discovered was that, in fact, there was a very deep connection between Asperger and Kanner, and that Kanner had then changed the conception of autism radically in a way that then produced the appearance of an epidemic later.
So say more about that. How did Kanner shift?
Well, let me tell you first what I discovered, because it gets very much to the question that you asked me about the history of science. The thing about Asperger is that, you know, his name is usually associated with Asperger syndrome. Most people think he discovered Asperger's syndrome. And what I discovered was that really what he discovered was what we now call the autism spectrum, this very wide range of really related conditions. Asperger also believed that autism was very, very common and very, very old. In fact, he said that once you learn to recognize the distinctive traits of autism, you see them everywhere. And he saw sort of familiar figures from pop culture, like the absent-minded professor, as probably being based on autistic people. But what no one had done before my book was they had never placed Asperger in his historical and social context. And that proved to be enormously important for the development of his diagnosis. So here was the context. In the years before 1938, Asperger and his colleagues had a very, very progressive clinic going on at the University of Vienna. They had art on the walls. Even the furniture was nice. They had classes. It wasn't the sort of place where a kid would be dropped off for a screening test or an evaluation. It was a place where the kids would actually live and go to school.
And this is because in that time, perhaps people with mental or behavioral issues were seen as somehow deviant and therefore shouldn't be catered to in a nice space. I'm trying to understand why you're making a point about the niceness of the space.
Right. Well, yes.
Because they would have otherwise been in asylums.
Right. Exactly. Okay. And but yet, actually, there was kind of a movement to humanize institutions, and Asperger's clinic was very, very much a part of that. But meanwhile, what no one had talked about before my book was that if you pull the camera back from this lovely place where the kid, you know, Asperger is literally reading poetry to the children, they're having music accompany their phys ed classes. It was a very progressive place. But if you pull the camera back, what's going on in the background? What's going on in the background is the rise of Nazism. And so in 1938, German soldiers march into Austria to annex the country for the Nazi fatherland. And the Nazis immediately start passing eugenics laws. And in fact, they launched a secret extermination program against disabled children called Action T4. And this was the practice run for the Holocaust against the Jews. So the Nazis were exterminating children with all different forms of disability, from schizophrenia to epilepsy to physical disabilities, and the children in Asperger's clinic became a target. And so one of the documents that I found was the very first public talk on autism ever given in history, which was given by Hans Asperger to an audience of Nazis in 1938, and he said in that talk, "I thought it best to tell you about my most promising cases." So now you understand why Asperger's paper, which was submitted to his Nazi mentor a few years later, described children who were less disabled than the children in Connor's paper, because Asperger knew that the children in his clinic would be exterminated if he didn't suggest that they could play a productive role in society. And in fact, at one point, Asperger even suggested that his autistic patients would make excellent code breakers for the Nazis, which is something that advice that they ignored because they were so hell-bent on eugenics. But what eventually happened was that Asperger's Jewish colleagues had to leave for obvious reasons. They were purged from the university. And in order to escape to America, they had to find someone who would vouch for them, because there were very, very strict immigration laws, like the immigration laws that some people would like to pass these days, that limited the number of Jews that could come into the country. And so what you had to do was find someone who could vouch for you that you would get a job and not have to live on welfare. And the man who heroically vouched for two of Asperger's Jewish colleagues was Leo Kanner. So when Leo Kanner, quote-unquote, discovered autism, he had two of Asperger's closest colleagues with him, actually. And in fact, in 1938, when a guy named Donald Triplett, who was Leo Kanner's first autistic patient, showed up at Johns Hopkins, Kanner did not know what to make of him, so he sent him to be evaluated by George Frankel, who was Asperger's diagnostician. And Frankel knew exactly what to make of him, because by that point they'd seen more than 100 autistic kids. The problem was that the model of autism that Leo Kanner then developed, Frankel and his wife, Ani Weiss Frankel, who had been a psychologist at Asperger's Clinic, Kanner was unable to find a permanent job for them. Unfortunately, they left. And the model that Kanner developed was much narrower and more monolithic than the model that Asperger and Frankel had developed.
And why is that, with the proximity to people who had worked with Asperger?
Well, I think it's because there's a very good reason. I think it's because Leo Kanner was one of the first child psychiatrists in America. And so he was really launching an entire field. He wasn't just launching a diagnosis. And autism was seen as actually the way Kanner saw it was as a form of psychosis. So one reason why adults were not on Kanner's radar was that he was a child psychiatrist. So he was really only looking at children. But also I think he wanted to draw the boundaries of the diagnosis very crisply and cleanly, so that the diagnosis would be accepted by his colleagues in the sort of newly emerging field of child psychiatry. But unfortunately what he did was he made the definition a little too narrow. So he, for instance, would decline to give a diagnosis to a child who had seizures. Seizures are actually very common in autism. He declined to give a diagnosis if the child was obviously intellectually disabled. In fact, intellectual disability is quite common in autism. He didn't really write about patients of color. So he tended to see autism as a problem of sort of hyper-ambitious, yuppie families. Well, those were the families that had access to Leo Kanner's office. So Leo Kanner's model of autism turned out to be way too narrow.
And so then with – how does that take us forward, right? So mm-hmm. Kanner becomes the predominant view. Asperger –
the only view.
The
Asperger,
only view. Really, Kanner's yeah. – I mean, Asperger's is a sort of footnote for people like you to find right. digging through articles and such.
Right.
So tell us how that then takes – this sort of medical model that's very narrow, which looks at deficits in function as opposed to Asperger's, which was – well, in some ways, written in a narrow way because it was, but it was looking at the other end, the higher functioning, for very good humanitarian reasons. How does this then carry forward?
Well, what happened was, it basically, for decades, it became very, very difficult to get a diagnosis of autism for a child in America. For instance, I spoke to a clinician who started working in the field in the 1940s, so very, very early, right after Connor had really developed the diagnosis. And she told me that even through the 1980s, by the time that she diagnosed a child with autism, the families had usually been through 10 clinicians by the point that they got to her. So in other words, you had to, you know, sort of doctor shop your way to an autism diagnosis for your child, because this definition was so narrow, and also because there was this pervasive belief that autism was very rare. In fact, I spoke to clinicians who were told, if they told their colleagues that they had seen an autistic child, their colleagues would tell them, well, you know, this is really a rare opportunity for you. You will never see another one. And that was completely wrong. So what happened was that Leo Connor, unfortunately, although also for very good reasons, suggested a couple of years after he wrote his paper that the cause of autism, or one of the causes of autism, was bad parenting. In fact, he, you know, his theory sort of gave rise to this cultural stereotype of the so-called refrigerator mother. Parents who were so hyper-ambitious and emotionally cold that they were unable to offer nurturance and love to their children. And as a result, Leo Connor's recommended course of treatment for autism was institutionalization, to remove the child from the allegedly toxic family environment. And once the child was institutionalized, it's not like there were these luxurious autism wards or progressive clinics like the one that Asperger and his colleagues had run. They were put on psych wards or in state hospitals for the so-called mentally retarded, a term that we don't use anymore, thank God. But there they were subjected to truly brutal and wacky forms of treatment. Like, there was a woman at Bellevue who was the head of psychiatry who gave a group of autistic children LSD every single day for 3 months until she realized that they were becoming more anxious. Well, who wouldn't become more anxious if they took LSD every day for 3 months? And children were subjected to lobotomies and electric shock, and, you know, it was really a brutal era. Meanwhile, parents were totally isolated from one another because they were carrying this tremendous burden of guilt for having, in a sense, caused their child's autism. And I have spoken to older parents who told me that their psychiatrist told them to quietly remove their children's photos from the family albums and never speak of them again. And so this was, in a sense, a life sentence, both for the children and the parents, who were often sent into a decade of psychoanalysis, which, you know, they did not cause their child's autism. They usually loved them tremendously. But it was a terrible, terrible thing for both the children and the parents.
So you paint Leo Connor in quite a negative light there, as sort of really being the person for whom all of this then occurred. Is he truly the sort of the villain in this book?
Well, no, not at all. You know, people, here's the thing. People ask me, like, well, who are the heroes of your book and who are the villains? And, you know, the thing is that almost everyone in the book has a mixed legacy, as in fact we probably all do as human beings. So, you know, Hans Asperger did many good things. He was also working for Nazis. So, you know,
he tailored his reports to
right, exactly,
to avoid the
extermination,
right, of the lower functioning people with,
exactly,
with autism type.
And Leo Connor, you know, think about it. He not only rescued George Frankl and Annie Weiss Frankl, he rescued actually more than 100 other Jewish clinicians. So Leo Connor was heroic in that sense. And he was also an excellent writer, I have to say. His 1943 paper was so vivid and so indelible and such a clear picture of what autism looks like that it became the, you know, in a sense, the clinical face of autism for decades, and in many ways still is. So I don't want to suggest that Leo Connor was, you know, a bad guy. I think he was probably a good guy. But in a sense, one of the things that makes the history of autism so difficult is that in many cases, it's people with good intentions whose actions end up having sort of unforeseen circumstances. So, you know, Leo Kanner didn't realize, I think, that by blaming parents, he would cast this very dark shadow over autistic people and their families for decades. But yet it happened.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight I'm in conversation with Steve Silberman, author of the book Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And I invite you now, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments. Do you or a loved one experience autism? Have you been diagnosed with autism? If so, what has been the impact on you and your family? What do you make of this historical perspective of how we've come to understand autism has taken shape? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So tell us, first I want to say, what is the current understanding, the key features of what autism is? And then I want you to tell us how we got to that, right? Because there was this broadening.
Sure.
So how did that? So first, well, what is it that we understand autism to be now, and how do we get there?
Well, autistic people are very challenged by particularly real-time social interactions. So they have a hard time parsing body language, tone of voice, exhibiting the expected body language that non-autistic people use to subtly communicate with one another. Some autistic people can't speak at all. Some autistic people who can't speak at all can speak when given a keyboard, so they can type. Others cannot. Autism is a sort of a constellation of very distinctive behaviors that, when you see them together, add up to autism.
So more like a syndrome,
right?
Than
exactly.
A disease,
it's
specifically.
A syndrome, right? I never use the word disease. It's a syndrome, it's interesting because at the same time, some autistic people, not all, but some autistic people have very striking abilities. For instance, many autistic people, many more than non-autistic people actually, have perfect pitch, which is the ability to accurately gauge what musical note is being played without hearing any other reference notes. Some autistic people have extraordinary memories. In fact, there's an autistic artist named Stephen Wiltshire, who's a black kid who lives in England. Well, he's not a kid anymore. He's a young adult. He sort of famously, you can find this on the web, he took a helicopter ride above Manhattan for 20 minutes, and then over the next few days, he was able to draw a very accurate picture of Manhattan from what he saw, including all the buildings. Some autistic people will memorize a musical performance after only hearing it once and then be able to play it. Now, these things are usually referred to as savant abilities, but even that conception, I think, is a little too limiting because, it's usually said that savant abilities are very rare, but certain feats of memory and things like perfect pitch are actually quite common in autism. I mean, it may not be being able to remember a whole opera, but it may be being able to recite long sections of dialogue from Disney movies, which is the subject of a really delightful book and movie coming out now called Life Animated by Ron Suskind. His son, Owen, was able to completely remember these exchanges between characters in Disney movies. And even though he lost his speech when he was very young, Ron Suskind and his wife were able to sort of enter his world by talking to him like Disney characters. And I would definitely recommend that book and that movie.
And if you had to say sort of the distribution, yeah, of those types of curious, unique traits or abilities, mm-hmm, within the larger group of people who are now diagnosed as autistic, when it comes to their functional challenges, how would you
well,
describe the spread there?
That's an interesting way to put it, because the truth of the matter is you can even have those abilities and still face very, very serious challenges in daily functioning. So if you're unable to make your wishes known to the person that you're talking to, or if you can't talk at all, then the fact that you have, you know, this amazing memory may not really help you in daily life much, but yet it's still interesting and still a very distinctive thing about autism. So I would say that, you know, one of the reasons why I stress in both my book and my talks the need for more support and services for families is that autism really is a very serious disability. I'm not making light of it by saying that, you know, this guy took a helicopter ride or, you know, et cetera. The truth of the matter is that most autistic people face very, very profound challenges in their daily lives. And the rate of unemployment for autistic people is truly shocking. And part of that is because autism is a challenging condition. But another part of it is that we haven't learned to build accommodations for autistic people yet. So, you know, if you're in a wheelchair, 50 years ago, being in a wheelchair was extremely disabling. You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't go to school. You couldn't even get down the sidewalk because there were curbs. But we've learned how to build a world in which being in a wheelchair is much less of a disability. And we're only starting now to figure out what kinds of accommodations and supports could make life easier for autistic people and their families.
So is the reason why the accommodation has lagged because the focus was somewhere else?
Yes, it's because autism was mistakenly considered very, very rare. In fact, you know, I even read papers were written in the 70s where people would write, you know, I'm sorry that I'm writing this paper about this completely obscure condition, but it's kind of interesting. Anyway, that was wrong. I mean, I think the CDC's current estimate, which, by the way, it's leveling off. You know, there have been these years of dramatic increases, but and I can talk about how we came to that broad model because that's very, very important. What happened was in the 1970s, a cognitive psychiatrist in England named Lorna Wing, who herself had a very profoundly autistic daughter named Susie, was asked by a public health official to estimate the number of children in a London suburb called Camberwell who had autism. And so she and a colleague named Judith Gould went out and really pounded the pavement and went out there in the community and dug through old medical records to try to find all the kids in Camberwell who had autism. And they were very, very surprised because at that point, all they knew of was Connor's very narrow model, and they assumed it was correct, as all their colleagues did. But they saw all these kids who didn't quite fit a Connor diagnosis. In fact, Connor was so closely associated with the diagnosis. Autism was more commonly called Connor syndrome, actually. But they found these kids who, for instance, obviously loved their parents. Connor had written about kids who seemed not even to be interested in knowing their parents at all. And yet the kids that Lorna and Judith found obviously loved their parents, so they would help their mom do the dishes and then go into the room to listen to their favorite record 25 times over. So what Lorna and Judith saw was really what we now call the spectrum. And they didn't know how to make sense of their data until Lorna happened to come across a reference to this obscure paper that had never even been translated from the German by Hans Asperger. And Leo Connor had never mentioned Asperger's name, even though he had worked with two of Asperger's closest colleagues, in his own work on autism. In fact, I found the place where Connor eventually uttered Asperger's name, which was in a dismissive book review written in the 1970s, so all the damage was done. And he said, oh yes, Asperger. What that person discovered was, at best, a 42nd cousin of my syndrome. In fact, you know, Asperger's work was still unknown, but her husband, Lorna's husband, spoke German. So he translated it for her. She read it and she said, yes, this is what I'm seeing in Camberwell.
And so then how did that take off? I mean, again, when you talk about the history of science, the sort of the, you know, science changes slowly. There's a lot of the sort of conventional wisdom that is entrenched, and it takes a lot to kind of push against what was a lifetime's work in Connor's case. So how did she push through?
Well, what she did was she went to the editors of the the so-called Bibles of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, and the International Classification of Diseases, which is the equivalent of the DSM used in other countries. And she in several different steps and a couple of different editions, introduced the concept of Asperger's syndrome, which was sort of chatty, kids who would often not get diagnosed until they were older. One of the reasons why she introduced the Asperger's syndrome diagnosis was it didn't contain the word autism. And if you remember what I said earlier about parents being heavily stigmatized for having autistic kids, many parents were willing to accept a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome because it didn't contain the word autism. So she did that. And in one of the reasons why other clinicians were so ready to adopt these changes in the DSM was that it made sense of the patients they were seeing. It made better sense of the patients they were seeing than Connor's really narrow model. And in fact, autistic people, particularly adults, were misdiagnosed with many other things. One of the biggest misdiagnoses was childhood schizophrenia. If you look at the history of childhood schizophrenia, in the 50s, it was considered an epidemic in state schools and mental institutions. Now we know that childhood onset schizophrenia is actually very, very rare. But the criteria for diagnosing childhood schizophrenia was so close to what we now call the spectrum that, in fact, those criteria were imported wholesale into autism research.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're talking with author Steve Silberman about his book, Neurotrauma: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. The number to dial to join our conversation this evening is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So what happened then once the definition broadened?
What happened was diagnoses like Asperger's syndrome became more popular than anyone could have possibly imagined. There was another diagnosis with the incredibly cumbersome name of pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified that was another sort of flavor of the spectrum. And as I describe in my book, that diagnosis absolutely soared in part because of a typo. As we were saying earlier, autism is a syndrome, and so it's a cluster of conditions. So you could look at it as, like, in a sense, a Chinese menu where you're supposed to choose one from column A and one from column B and one from column C. However, instead of the word "and" in the DSM when the PDD-NOS was introduced, it said "or." So in a sense, you could get the whole banquet for just one, you know, a display of one trait. And so PDD-NOS was sort of, you know, probably wildly overdiagnosed for a while. It took actually years for that typo to be corrected. So what happened was the number of diagnoses started soaring, which was exactly as Lorna Wing not only predicted but hoped, because since she was the mother of a profoundly disabled autistic daughter, she knew how hard it was to raise such a child with no access to special education, no services, no support. So for her, the rise in diagnoses meant that more families like hers were getting help. But then along came this guy, Andrew Wakefield, a gastroenterologist in London who ran a study that has been comprehensively debunked, disowned by its co-authors, retracted, called a deliberate fraud by the British Medical Journal, etc. And he claimed that the reason for the rise in diagnoses was vaccines. And he's still claiming it, actually.
One particular vaccine, correct?
Not the vaccines. MMR vaccine.
Okay, not right. All vaccines.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, his original paper didn't even draw a causal link between the MMR vaccine and autism. But what he did was, there was sort of a highly touted press conference when that paper was released. And it was at that press conference that he told the British tabloids, who are, you know, prone to writing these hysterical horror story headlines, that the MMR vaccine was responsible for the rise in autism. And I have heard him on tape saying that he, quote-unquote, knew nothing about autism before he ran his study. So he went from knowing nothing about autism to running the study that was then retracted, debunked, and disowned, and then suddenly he's the world expert on why autism diagnoses are going up. And Anyway, I don't believe what Wakefield says.
Obviously. But interestingly enough, the concern that vaccines have to have, or the MMR vaccine in this case, have to have some role in the development of autism persists, especially here in California, to this day. So why?
Well, do you know something I have to say? I completely understand why. And by the way, you know, one of the sort of stereotypes of so-called anti-vaxxers is that they're, you know, they're ignorant or they don't follow science, et cetera. In fact, many parents who have reservations about vaccines are incredibly industrious researchers at what Jenny McCarthy used to call the University of Google. So it's not right to dismiss their concerns. The other thing is that, I mean, even though the theory that vaccines cause autism is wrong, it's not right to dismiss them. The other thing is that basically Big Pharma is not our friend necessarily. Like, they are capable of doing really bad things as well as doing really incredibly great things. So, you know, I wrote for Wired as a science writer for many years. I'm aware that Big Pharma in the past had even, you know, covered up studies showing the ill effects of one of their popular medications, et cetera. But so, in other words, it was a very, very believable and simple story for parents. And it was one that was sort of reiterated all the time, even by organizations that parents trusted very much, like Autism Speaks. For years, Autism Speaks, which is the largest fundraising organization for autism in America, would use the word epidemic in its own press conferences. In fact, they even said it at a CDC press conference, even though the CDC itself had not said anything about an epidemic. And so parents hear the word epidemic. They hear about the, you know, the study about vaccines. It was a very plausible story. It just didn't happen to be the right story. And one of the reasons why I wrote Neurotribes was that I, you know, particularly once I had done all my research, I wanted to tell a story that explained why the numbers have been going up so drastically, but that was actually true instead of being a false story.
So we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Denise in San Francisco. Denise, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling about something I read in The Untold History of the United States by Alva Stone and Peter Kuznick. And it says that in Mein Kampf, Hitler lauded American leadership in the field of eugenics. He later informed his Nazi colleagues, "I have studied with great interest the laws of several American states concerning prevention of reproduction by people whose progeny would in all probability be of no value or be injurious to the racial stock." Do you have a comment on that, please?
Yes, that is, that's an absolutely true thing. And you'll be glad to know that a large part of my chapter about Hans Asperger talks about how eugenics was really an idea that was developed in America with the support of major institutions like the Rockefeller Foundation. In fact, we literally sent researchers to Germany to train clinicians in eugenic theory. So the idea that Hitler got the idea of eugenics from America, that is absolutely true. And in fact, I provide a tremendous amount of documentation in that regard in my book.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Denise, for your call, which this, again, it goes back to that, that what we talked about at the top of the hour, which is the context, the historical context, the political context that that Leo Kanner was operating in, right? Eugenics was a big deal here established at the time. So it's not that he was what's the word I'm looking for? He was acting in a vacuum.
Right. And, you know, Kanner was not a eugenicist. He was an anti-eugenicist. In fact, he sort of famously debated this eugenicist in a paper. But the thing is that eugenics was not considered fringe science in America in the 1940s. It was mainstream science. And, you know, parts of the book that horrified me to write were about how these American institutions hosted these enormous conferences on, you know, quote unquote, the Jewish problem or the Negro problem. And, you know, eugenics, those racialist ideas were very firmly entrenched in American science.
So let's keep with this, the explosion of the diagnosis, in your view, based on the fact that the criteria had widened. And in many ways that people were looking for a way to explain it. That was vaccines, and you're saying not true, convenient but not true. Besides, can you account for the explosion of the diagnosis based solely on the expansion of the criteria?
Well, you know, speaking in absolutes is never a very good idea in science. So this is what I would say. Let's just say for the, you know, to play my own devil's advocate, let's say that there has been some true small, what they call a secular rise in autism in recent years. If that is the case, then what you need to do to find out what's going on with those children is to lift out all the increase that have been caused by this radical expansion of the diagnosis. The autism as it is conceived now was not your grandfather's autism, you could say. It is really radically expanded. So if you wanted to zero in on a group of children who were vulnerable to something or other, what you would need to do is remove this giant iceberg of diagnoses that were caused by the radical expansion of the diagnosis. And so that's what my book does. And in a sense, when I talk to, you know, sometimes when I talk to anti-vaccine people, I want to say, well, here's the thing. What I just did was remove a tremendous amount of statistical noise from that equation. So go for it. Look for it. See if you can find that group.
And what do you think? Where are we going to find it?
This is my point. The way that we have been facing the challenge of autism as a society, we've been pretending that it's a new condition. We've been pretending that it's a condition that has radically increased in recent years because of some factor in the environment, even if, you know, if it's not vaccines, it's Wi-Fi or antidepressants in the water supply or too much video gaming. You hear all these things.
Or older dads.
Older dads, actually, I think maybe if there is a true secular increase in autism, I think older parents in general actually might actually be a factor, because people really are waiting a lot longer. I mean, my parents had me when they were 18, when they were teenagers. That was very common in my generation. Now people wait until their 30s and 40s, and there have been studies that suggest that that older parents may have more of a chance of having autistic kids
because of genetic mutations
exactly.
in their sperm.
Accumulation of mutations. But here's the thing. We have been so obsessed as a society at looking at the cause for autism or causes. Meanwhile, the families of autistic people and autistic people themselves have been left to twist in the wind. And so if you talk to parents, they say that when their kids so-called age out of services after high school, there is nothing for them. There are no transition programs, no job training programs, even for kids who are very capable of working and really eager to work. There are very few housing options. So think of it this way. What if instead of building wheelchair ramps and accessible classrooms, we were saying as a society, forget all that. Someday science will enable everyone to walk. That's exactly not only what we've been saying as a society as regards to autism, but it's how we've been spending our money. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars of research on looking for causes of autism, primarily in the human genome, but also in the environment. What if we had spent a fraction of that on developing more easily usable and accessible communication technology?
So do you advocate that we stop looking for a cause, or we just kind of add more resources
to the support. Right. We
stop
deceiving ourselves as a society and saying we're really tackling the serious challenges of autism by giving academic geneticists $50 million more. I'm saying, you know, I'm a big fan of science. I'm a science writer. It's in part a science book. I was a science writer for Wired. Many of my friends are scientists. I like science. However, at the same time, we need to supplement the science with support for autistic people and their families.
Let's go to Kathleen. Kathleen, welcome to the program. Kathleen is on line 2, I think, right? Yeah. Kathleen, welcome to the program.
I hope I can be clear on this. I have come across studies linking autism, what the effects of autism is: nitric oxide imbalance in the body, and also you can get nitric oxide imbalance from mercury exposure, which was, I don't know if it's still in vaccines, but it certainly was, and also from electromagnetic field exposure, you can get nitric oxide imbalance. So, I mean, there's three isolated things I'm talking about here, and I don't know, is anybody in this country anyway looking into this?
Yes. Well, the problem is that, you know, when the mercury came out of the vaccines, the autism rate did not drop at all. So, again, you know, we're obsessing about this or that. And, you know, there are really a billion theories. In fact, there's a woman named Emily Willingham, who is a science blogger, who sort of wrote a compilation of theories of things that cause autism. And her headline was, "This Just In: Being Alive Linked to Autism." So there is a proliferation of these theories about this or that chemical. And mercury, for one, has not been found to cause autism. And so, anyway, what I'm suggesting is that we really need to return our concern to what happens to families and to autistic people in the absence of services. And the truth of the matter is, it's terrible.
Let's go next to Maddie in Sausalito. Maddie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm in my 60s, and I've been living abroad for many years, and I study cultural anthropology. And interestingly, I was in Ireland in 2009 when I first heard the term Asperger, and the family that had this 12-year-old who was an Asperger, as I rode in the car with them, the mom was explaining to me her son's condition. I just thought it was cute to remark that in Ireland, innocently and rather cutely, their Asperger kids are given, like, you know, they're like little kings and queens because they associate Asperger's with Einstein. So these are all little Einsteins, and they're quite catered to in school systems, et cetera. But anyway, when I returned to the United States, having eventually realized that I had some qualities in common with high-functioning autism Asperger's, I took that test, and sure enough, I was borderline. And then I realized that my mother, who unfortunately struggled lifelong trying to figure out what was wrong with her, like, what's that, bipolar, she was given every single diagnosis, she's now so old that she doesn't care anymore, she clearly was an Asperger, brilliant woman. And my question was, as I looked into this, I heard that one child every 4 days in the state of California is diagnosed, I think through the schools they said, as high-functioning or Asperger, high-functioning autism. And when I looked at my own bottom line issues, I am highly sensory perceptive. And so as a child, I had a very caring, intelligent father who was a psychologist originally, so I had a lot of support. But I pulled my hair out as a child, all these things, and I eventually adapted. But my issue was, I realize, is in a very boisterous household, emotion and loud noise or commotion caused me to withdraw and made me extremely uncomfortable. And my question is, in regarding
Maddie, I'm going to have to ask you to get to that question because we have very few minutes left.
Sorry. Diagnosed high-end functioning. Is there anything in the school system where they recognize that there are a lot of children that suffer from sensory noise, light, too much commotion? Is there an awareness of that and something that's being done in the school systems to cater to that?
You know, I have to say I really appreciate everything that you said. And I think it's a very common experience, for particularly for women. And for one thing, you mentioned that, you know, you see sort of traits of Asperger syndrome throughout your family. That's very common because autism is very highly heritable. So it often runs in family trees. There is now, in part because of this appreciation for what's called neurodiversity. Neurodiversity is a word that was coined by a woman whose mother was on the autism spectrum, and her daughter was on the autism spectrum. And what she wanted to do was coin a word that would be not automatically pathologizing, like terms like Asperger's syndrome disorder or whatever, autism spectrum disorder. So as we become more aware of the great need of many, many children in the school system for accommodations like quiet rooms or chill out rooms or non-fluorescent lighting, because many people with autistic traits are bothered by fluorescent lighting. One of the things that I constantly talk about in my talks is the need for environments that autistic children can actually thrive in, rather than sort of be in a continuous state of sensory overload and meltdown.
I wonder, though, if we would get to a place where we'd realize that that's good for any child.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Especially with all the screen time and, right. and all the, and the bombardment with the types of images and messages that we have. So,
definitely.
So tell us a little bit more about this concept of neurodiversity and how you think it's going to take us to the next level of understanding.
Well, here's how it originated. There was an Australian sociology student named Judy Singer, and as I say, both her mother and her daughter were on the spectrum. And she joined a very early online community for autistic adults. And by sharing their stories, they discovered that many of the problems they faced in life were not, in a sense, symptoms of autism. They were symptoms of how society was either not meeting their needs or treating them badly in the case of bullying and unemployment. So Judy coined the term neurodiversity as sort of a rallying cry, in the same way that phrases like gay is good or black is beautiful or sisterhood is powerful had been a rallying cry for other marginalized and stigmatized communities. Now the term neurodiversity is being widely adopted by autistic people to define themselves and to sort of become tell their own stories, really, and seek their own autonomy and express their own view of the world. And it's I have to say, it's really taking off. It was I gave the keynote speech at the United Nations last April, and the theme of the that day, World Autism Awareness Day, was neurodiversity. There was just the first neurodiversity-themed conference in Africa. So it's a different way of conceiving of autism that, for one thing, gives autistic people credit for having special skills as well as serious challenges in daily life, and also promotes the notion that what we need to be doing is supporting families and autistic people themselves.
So it sounds like we're heading towards a place where we have to have a sort of a look at ourselves as a society and look at our sociological norms and rethink them. So again, here an interesting intersection between science and sociology and such. So thinking of things like the Americans with Disabilities Act that have led to a lot of the accommodations you've talked about, how do you see this translating into policy, into funding, into really the shift? And how long is it going to take? Because it doesn't happen overnight.
Right. It doesn't happen overnight. And yet I want to bring up an example of a really radical shift at that same level that happened, I have to say, fairly quickly. When I was in high school, I had a quote-unquote condition that was defined as a mental disorder in the DSM. It was called homosexuality. And now I'm a very happily married gay man. That is a radical, sweeping, profound societal shift that happened within my lifetime. And so, one of the things that we have to do is stop obsessing about epidemics and causes and start really paying attention to how we're treating autistic people and their families. And so there are signs of great promise on the horizon. I'll give you a very clear example. There's a giant software company called SAP. It's a multinational corporation. And they started a pilot project in India to hire autistic people to work in high tech. That project worked out so well that they are now launching other projects in 7 countries, and they have committed themselves to hiring thousands of autistic employees for the high tech industry in the coming years. What you find is that if you build something for autistic people and their families, they come. And they do much better, usually, than people predict. And so those resources are only now being put in place. So I think we're on the verge of a sweeping societal transformation in terms of not just autism, but how we think of many different cognitive disabilities, including ADHD and dyslexia.
Okay. It looks like we have here an email from Harmony that we summarized here. It says, one of the benefits to autistics is that they are very literal and do not get caught up in social issues of social pressure or status. This gives them a very unique point of view. In my experience, what autistics need most is direct assistance to function within our socially centered world. They need advocates and assistants that help them to find the beneficial outlets for their interests and skills so that they can contribute their gifts and genius to our society.
I have to say that's fantastic, Harmony. Thank you. I couldn't have said it better myself.
So are we saying, again, that if we as a world become more accommodating, that there really – this could sort of – the all the boats rise here for autistic people? Are there going to be some people whose impairments and functional barriers are going to just not be able to be accommodated?
Well,
kind of get a sense of
here's the thing.
What's possible.
Accommodation for disability tends to have a resonating effects throughout the culture that could not have been foreseen. For instance, closed captions on television. Obviously, they were put there for people who are deaf, and yet everyone at the treadmill at the gym reading the news on the screen appreciates them. Same thing with curb cuts. Parents who push a stroller down the street appreciate the fact that they don't have to bump the baby over a curb. Well, I think we'll find that the same things produce benefits throughout society, including for non-autistic people, when we put them in place for autistic people and their families. So I'm sorry, I forget exactly where I was going with that. But I think that once we make society more open.
I'm saying, is there a possibility you see that there's going to be some people with autism who will be left out, with these accommodations?
All right, here's the thing. What I'm asking for is more services and support for families. I'm not saying, let's give, support to all the young Mark Zuckerbergs out there or something like that. I'm saying that families who need 24/7 support for their nonverbal children should be able to have more housing options than the grim kinds of institutions that they're faced with now. So what I would say is that we really need to provide services and support all across the spectrum, because it's very broad.
And in the year that your book has been published, what do you think you left out, you wished you had put in, or things that you might feel like you got wrong in this book?
Well, one of the things that let me think if I did I get anything wrong. There was another book that came out called In a Different Key that had access to a scholar named Herwig Czech, who declined to give me his information for some reason, even though I was asking for it for 5 years, where he had evidence that Hans Asperger signed a letter of referral that condemned a disabled girl to death. Well, what I did, he still actually declines to give me his information, but what I did was I was able to find out where he got it. And it turns out that the girl was profoundly disabled. She did not have autism. Her parents were very fervent Nazis who begged Asperger to put her to death, sadly. And one of the small differences between the paperback and the hardcover, because it's basically the same book, the paperback is coming out tomorrow, I'm happy to say. But one of the small differences is that I added a paragraph to talk about that, because I didn't want to leave anything out. I didn't want to, present an unreasonably sunny picture of Asperger. He was working for Nazis. People had to make accommodations when their bosses were Nazis or faced death themselves. So one of the things that he did, very tragically, was that he probably signed this letter of referral at the behest of this poor girl's parents. So that's one minor change. I mean, the book is basically the same, and no, I haven't found a bunch of things that I got wrong, which I'm actually incredibly happy about, considering it's 500 pages long.
So where do you go next?
Where do I go next? I have no idea what next book I'm going to write. Where I go next, literally, is Australia, because they're having an autism conference there next week that is billed as autism-friendly and is going to feature a bunch of autistic self-advocates, people with autism who are working for the benefit of their fellow people on the spectrum. So that's where I'm literally going next. I have a lot of, kind of speaking gigs for the remainder of the year, and I'll still be doing that.
And do you feel like this is your last book on autism?
Yeah, I think so.
Your first and last?
I think so, in part because, it was such a – I mean, it's been, by now 6 or 7 years of my life. But also, I think that in a way, autistic people should be really leading the societal conversation about their condition. So one of the great things that's happening is that autistic people are writing their own books, and I wish them well.
And we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank my guest this evening, Steve Silberman, author of the book Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, which is being released in paperback tomorrow. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It was a pleasure.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang, with special thanks to in-studio producer Ann Harper. Please join my co-host Ethan Elkine next Monday for a discussion of California's Prop 64, aiming to legalize recreational use of cannabis, also known as marijuana. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week. Thank you.